Well, welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We're very fortunate today. We're going to be speaking to Zafar Benghesh, and he is with crescent.icit-digital.org. But just go Crescent, you will find Zafar Benghesh. Zafar is quite well known to our listeners and one of the most knowledgeable people on matters to do with Islam in the Middle East. And boy, do we have a lot of questions. Zafar, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Phil, and nice to see you after such a long time. I hope you are keeping well.
And same to you. And that's going to have to be part of our discussion is COVID-19 and its impact on all these events that we're going to be talking about, and even the health of our communities, which I have to say in North America, we don't seem to have the same social structure that exists in other places, which where there seems to be more regard for science and for protecting the population. I better ask you a rather urgent question, and I know that this has to be on your mind. In Bahrain, there are a number of people who are scheduled to be executed at any moment. As a matter of fact, for all I know, they have been. I've seen calls going out from various places. Can you remind us what has happened in Bahrain? It's for all the talk from the State Department and elsewhere about human rights. We don't hear about Bahrain. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The people of Bahrain are absolutely fed up of the ruling family that is a minority, a tiny minority. Although I don't wish to sort of look at this purely from a sectarian perspective, but we cannot avoid going to that issue because more than 90% of the population in Bahrain is Shia. And the ruling family is Sunni. And they have been kept in power by the Americans, the Saudis, and so on. And naturally, when the people of Bahrain demand their fundamental rights, which is human rights, human dignity, the right to vote, the regime unleashes its reign of terror. And so these death sentences, etc., that they have imposed on these people are primarily because the people are demanding their fundamental rights. Of course, Bahrain is, as I'm sure your listeners would know, there is the U.S. naval base in Bahrain. And so the Americans obviously want to keep it that way. And if, let's say, this particular family were to lose control, then the people would demand that this American Fifth Fleet is basically based over there. And from there, the Americans launch their wars of aggression against other countries in the region. And so that is really why the Americans are supporting the Bahraini regime. And that's also why the Saudis are supporting this regime. But it's essentially the fundamental rights of the people of Bahrain that demand that they should be given those rights so that they can choose and decide for themselves what kind of a government they want in the country.
You know, it strikes me as it's a leftover from a sort of false dawn story that when the U.S. was interested in regime change a few years back, and it was time of Obama, in that region, they had this expression, the Arab Spring. And unfortunately, for the mass of the population of Bahrain, they joined in and asked for their rights. And their demonstrations, my memory was they were peaceful demonstrations. And then they were crushed.
Yes. In fact, throughout these years of the Bahraini people's demands, they have been extremely peaceful. They have never, ever fought or taken up any arms or any, they have never resorted to any violence. They have been completely peaceful. They have, whenever, the military has come and demanded that these people disperse, they have. But unfortunately, the regime is so insecure because it knows that it's a minority regime. The overwhelming majority of the people do not support it. And the Bahraini people and their leadership have never resorted to violence, as was witnessed in some other countries. But even with that kind of a totally non-violent, peaceful demand for their rights, they have been ruthlessly suppressed. You know, literally hundreds of people have been thrown in jail. In fact, initially when they when the Bahraini people made the demand during the so-called Arab Spring, some of the people that were shot by the police and the military, when they ended up in hospital, the military then went into the hospitals and dragged these people from their hospital beds, even though they were wounded, just dragged them out and took them and threw them in jail. So the violence has actually been entirely perpetrated by the regime and its forces, and the demonstrators have been completely peaceful.
We're speaking to Zafar Benghash. He is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought and on the editorial board of Crescent International. Canada has relations with Bahrain, doesn't it? Friendly relations?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes. Canada has friendly relations.
Well, I have to ask you, I thought we put sanctions on people who executed children.
Yes, I know. But that, you see, this is where the... This is where this is where the problem arises, that, you know, when it's our own friends and allies, then you know, we just overlook those things. So you can see that, you know, Saudi Arabia, which is the patron saint of Bahrain together with the United States, also has this atrocious record of executing people publicly. They behead them publicly. And it's a spectacle that they you know, want the rest of the people to see, to terrorize them. And yet, despite demands from a very large number of people in Canada, Canadian citizens, that Canada should not be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, yet our government continues to sell them weapons. $15 billion worth of, you know, that was a contract that was signed during Harper's time. And of course, the liberals at that time were saying that, well, this was a contract that another government had signed. But now that they are, the liberals are in power, they have an opportunity to cancel that contract. They refuse to do so. In fact, the Canadian government, after a while, last year, you know, it suspended the delivery of weapons for a while. But then this year, the Canadian government resumed a supply of weapons. And these are, of course, light armored personnel carriers that are manufactured in London, Ontario. And there have been protests even outside that manufacturing plant. Canadians have gone there asking that this plant be shut down and that, you know, Canada should not be supplying weapons that are being used against the Saudi people, incidentally, in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabia regime has used these weapons, although the contract specifically says that Saudi Arabia is not permitted to use these weapons against civilian population. And the Saudi regime has also used these weapons against the people of Yemen that the Saudis have been waging a war against since March of 2015. And hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Yemen. About more than 1 million children in Yemen are suffering from cholera. In fact, about a week or 10 days ago, in fact, on July the 10th, the World Food Program director for Yemen said that 10 million people in Yemen are on the verge of starvation, and that 22 million of Yemen's 24 million people are food deficient. So there is a desperate need for food and other desperately needed supplies to the people of Yemen. And yet here we have a situation whereby our own government in Ottawa is supplying the Saudis these terrible weapons that the Saudis are using against the Yemeni people.
We're speaking to Zafar Benghash, and Zafar is the, if I get this right, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, editorial board of Crescent. Zafar, we have a really important issue that in my mind, the media here is not covering at all well, and that is this issue that has flared up between the People's Republic of China and the government of India. The two armies actually had a physical encounter. They didn't use weapons. Apparently, they were fighting along at a border point. And I just have the feeling that this is not being contextualized here. What is this all about?
There are several dimensions to this story. And of course, we need to be aware of the history as well. But let me summarize it as follows. Of course, this whole issue is being, at least in the Western world, it's being looked at only in the context of the US and the Western world's policy to box in China, because China is a rapidly emerging economic superpower as well as a military power. That's why we see these American provocations in the South China Sea, and this Quad arrangement whereby Japan, the US, Australia, and India want to hold military exercises to challenge China's presence over there. And what India has done, and of course there has been a long history to this, but what India did was that in an area where there is an undemarcated border between the two countries' forces, and that undemarcated border is referred to as the line of actual control. And this line of actual control came into existence in October, November of 1962, when India and China had a war. And that war also emerged because of India's provocative actions at that time. But let me place it in the sort of context of exactly why this recent clash occurred between Indian and Chinese forces. And as you rightly pointed out, no weapons were used, or at least no firearms were used, because they had agreed previously that they would not use firearms in, when they, if there are any clashes. But this time, basically, clubs were used and stones and things like that. But this is a very, very rough terrain. There are mountainous peaks, very dangerous mountain ridges, etc. And apparently what took place was that the Indians had done several things that really alarmed the Chinese. So let me, you know, walk your listeners through this. Number one, back in 2008, the Indians opened or reopened an Air Force base right up, right at the top, about maybe 8-9 kilometers from the line of actual control. And that Air Force base had been evacuated by the Indians in the war with China in 1962. And that Air Force base is referred to as Daulat Beg Oldi Air Force Base. And this Air Force base is only about 10 kilometers from the Karakoram Pass that links China with Ladakh region. So number one, it is only 8-9 kilometers from the line of actual control. And then it is only 10 kilometers from the Karakoram Pass. That is the pass that the Chinese are able to come into the Ladakh region, which is of course a Buddhist region. And what the Indians did was that not only did they reoccupy that military base in 2008, but the Indian Air Force upgraded the runway to such an extent that now heavy military transport planes can also land at that base. That was the first provocative act by India. Of course, the Chinese protested about this, but the Indians just ignored it. Secondly, for nearly 20 years now, the Indians have been building an all-weather road that goes from the south all the way to this Air Force base. This 255 kilometers long road, which has basically reduced the travel time for Indian forces from the south to the north from 2 days to only 6 hours. And again, the Chinese protested about this road because the unwritten agreement between the two countries was that they will keep their forces 20 kilometers away from the line of actual control. Whereas this highway runs right next to the line of control, the line of actual control. More worrying than that for the Chinese was that the Indians started to build feeder roads from this highway. That means that if there is a clash, that they can immediately mobilize forces, get them to the highway, and get them to the points that the Indians need them to be. Now, we need to look at this in the context of what India did last year. On August the 5th of 2019, India unilaterally abrogated the autonomous status of the state of Jammu and Kashmir that is under Indian control. Then, in the Indian parliament, Indian ministers started to make announcements that they are going to take Aksai Chin as well. Now, Aksai Chin is a region which is under Chinese control, and it's, of course, Buddhist region, but it is crucial for China because there is a major highway, it's called the NH-219, that links the Chinese province of Xinjiang with Tibet. Now, the Indians were now so close to Aksai Chin along the line of control, actual control, and this highway that the Chinese became alarmed in the sense that Indian military moves in Ladakh region, number one. Secondly, abrogating the autonomous status of Jammu and Kashmir as well as of Ladakh, and Ladakh as well as Jammu and Kashmir were then taken under India's direct control. They are now being run directly from Delhi. And then Indian threats that they are going to take Aksai Chin as well from China. And then, of course, we know that India maintains this Tibet government in exile in India, whereas Tibet is under Indian control. So you add all of these things. The Chinese said, these Indians are not listening to us. They're getting, you know, very uppity. And of course, the Indians thought that because they have this strategic agreement with the U.S., that now that the U.S. is backing them, that they can take on China. And so the Chinese decided to teach the Indians a lesson, which they did on June the 15th and 16th, and they clubbed about 20 Indian soldiers to death, including the colonel who was in charge of Indian forces, Colonel Santosh Babu, as well as another officer that was with the colonel, a major, and 18 other Indian soldiers were killed. And the Chinese also captured about 10 Indian soldiers. Again, that included one colonel, three majors, and then other soldiers. But the Chinese then released them and let them go. But the latest situation that we have is that both countries have agreed to de-escalate and move their forces back. But the Indians, of course, continue to act in a provocative manner because they think that just because they have the Americans at their back, that the Americans are backing them, that they can somehow take on China. I believe they're making a big mistake because the Chinese know how to defend their interests. Although it is true that the Chinese do not want conflict in that region because this major highway, which is referred to as CPEC, China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, it runs a little bit further through Pakistani Kashmir, and this goes all the way up to the south or the southern naval port at Gwadar, which is at the southern tip of Pakistan. But this major highway that runs through Pakistan is a linchpin of China's Belt and Road Initiative, which basically would link China to Central Asia and onwards to Europe. And all of these countries and economies would be linked with China's economic grid. And I think it's important for your listeners to know that the Belt and Economic and Road Initiative of China is a multi-trillion dollars project, that China will invest trillions of dollars in all of these regions, building roads and bridges and railway lines so that trade could be encouraged and that these economies would act collaboratively rather than in a conflict situation. And regrettably, India is acting as a spoiler on behalf of the United States. And that is the reason why we have this conflict in that region, which of course has de-escalated, but my fears are that perhaps this may not necessarily last too long because the Americans want to provoke China or to encircle China. And unfortunately, the Indians are playing that dirty game on behalf of the Americans.
Speaking of Zafar Bengash, Crescent. You know, Zafar, I'm really glad you reminded us that, because there's a pattern. It was a disturbing one. I'm old enough, as the expression goes, to remember that it was Nehru, and I believe his foreign minister was a man named Krishna Menon. And people thought of them as anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist, and part of the struggle to end colonialism and really develop the previously colonialized world. And it was shocked when Nehru made an alliance basically with the British and Americans. Am I right?
Absolutely. In fact, the Chinese had been reaching out to the Indians, to Nehru and others, when he was the prime minister, that we should have, friendly relations. And yet the Indians, and it was Nehru, as you rightly pointed out, he had adopted what is referred to as the forward policy, which is a very aggressive policy, which essentially wanted to confront China and to browbeat it into submission, because Nehru had made a pact or deal with the British as well as the Americans. And of course, when the war erupted, again, it was as a result of Indian provocations. At that time, the Chinese did not want war, but there's a famous quotation from Mao Zedong, who was the Chinese leader at the time, that when the Indians were continuously provoking the Chinese, Mao Zedong said that, it would be impolite of us if the Indians continue to raise their head that we don't respond. So he said that I think we ought to respond, and we ought to sort of, take this matter into our own hands, because the Indians continue to be provoking us militarily. And I want to point out that when the war broke out, Nehru immediately appealed to the United States. And of course, Kennedy was the president at the time. And Kennedy had a meeting over there, and the Americans immediately dispatched fighter planes to India to support India against China. So here you have a situation whereby Nehru was constantly trying to project to the world that he's a leader of the non-aligned movement, that he's not aligned with any superpower, and yet he was appealing to the Americans and doing all of these deals with them. And of course, Kennedy wanted to do more and to send more supplies, but U.S. Defense Secretary at the time, McNamara, suggested that what we should do, what the United States should do, is to first of all study the situation and see what is the reality, rather than just plunging into it. That we don't want to plunge into a situation that we may not be able to get out of, because we end up at war with China. And so Kennedy decided to send his roving ambassador, Averell Harriman. And Harriman went to India, but by then the Chinese had already declared a ceasefire. This war in 1962 lasted for about a month, and whatever territory the Chinese wanted, they took possession of that. And then the Chinese unilaterally withdrew from the rest of the territory. They didn't want that territory, and they even released all of the Indian soldiers they had captured. Probably they thought that, feeding them dal and rice all every day was probably a little bit too much, because there are so many Indian soldiers that they had captured. They said, just go, just get lost, They gave them their shoes and their uniforms and sent them home. Yeah. And after that, there were discussions between India and China, and the two countries agreed that, number one, they will keep their armed forces 20 kilometers away from what is referred to as the line of actual control. And number two, that if there are clashes between them, that they are not going to use firearms, so that they would avoid casualties. And this was the situation that emerged in June of this year, or May, but then in June, and the Indians continued to be attacked provocatively, and so that is why we had this casualties that the Indians suffered as a consequence.
By the way, that really points up, you notice the propaganda around this crisis, and I'm really glad you gave us such a clear account, is that the Western media wanted a body count. They wanted to have casualties. They wanted to tell so that they could get, frankly, the blood flowing. That's my impression. And the Chinese refused to talk about that.
Said, yes, of course. The Chinese would not
talk about it.
Yeah, the Chinese refused to indulge in those things, and they sort of did not take the bait. What they simply said was that they would like to de-escalate, and they repeatedly called upon the Indians to de-escalate. They have no intention of continuing this conflict. They want the situation to return to normalcy as it was before these latest clashes erupted. Because you see, China's policy has been to not provoke military conflict unless they are provoked into a situation where it becomes absolutely intolerable for them not to engage in conflict. Because China's plan has always been that it is better to engage other countries in economic development. In fact, they've even offered to India. Repeatedly, the Chinese have offered to India to become part of the Belt and Road Initiative. But of course, regrettably, the Indians continue to spur this. They're not to be interested in it. Although the Chinese have invested a lot of money in India, something like $70 to $80 billion, the Chinese have invested in various companies in India. And this, of course, has helped India to develop its economy. But unfortunately, now that the Indians think that America is behind them and they would like to be part of the American nexus, that they want to take on China. Because the Indians have this silly notion that they think that they can rival China. Unfortunately, they cannot. The Chinese economy is many times larger than India's economy. China is an emerging superpower. And we can also see in terms of this pandemic that the Chinese have been able to contain it very successfully. The total number of deaths in China from the pandemic have been under 8,000, whereas India is now the third largest infectious country in the world with more than 1 million infections, and they have more than 26,000 deaths. Although my understanding is that India's deaths are much more, but because their entire system is so inefficient, many people, once the economy was shut down, many people went back into their villages, etc., because they had no livelihood in the major cities. And so India does not count the people that have died in the villages. So we won't really know the exact death toll, but I think the Indian death toll is much higher than what they have admitted so far, to something like 26,500 people dead. But the fact that about 1 million people have now, they have admitted, the government has admitted, more than 1 million people have been infected. It has affected India's economy very badly when we consider that there are 400 million people in India that live in absolute poverty. And this was before the pandemic. And so if you add to the fact that as to the ravages of the pandemic and the shutdown of the economy, we can safely assume that twice as many people, in fact, 800 million people or more, are now living in absolute poverty in India. So India is in no position to take on China, either militarily or economically. And yet, because it has aligned itself with the US, it thinks that it can undermine China, and somehow India can become the regional power, military power over there.
They're making themselves a cat's paw, and it's a dangerous occupation. We're speaking to Zafar Bengash, Crescent, and it seems, Zafar, we have so many hotspots to catch up with here. I think we should also remind ourselves, this is a quite dangerous situation. India does have nuclear weapons. China has nuclear weapons. And of course, the United States is pulling out of every agreement it ever signed to reduce or control nuclear weapons. And we're seeing very aggressive behavior and also events that are hard to understand who the players are. Let me give an example. Libya, what I understand, President Sisi of Egypt has said now he might step into Libya. And of course, we have President, I guess it is, Erdogan of Turkey, who's completely, deeply involved. All this is because the United States assassinated Gaddafi and destroyed a really healthy Arab country, Libya. So what are these, particularly Erdogan, a NATO member, what is going on there?
Yes, well, that's you raise a number of issues. First of all, let's recap for your listeners that Libya was the most progressive country in the whole of Africa. It is, of course, on the African continent. It's part of Africa, although it's also part of the Arab world. But despite the fact that Gaddafi was not democratically elected, but his policies were people-friendly. Just to remind your listeners that during his time, education for Libyans was completely free. It was paid for by the government. To whatever degree, whatever level the people want to study, right, all the way up to university, to PhD, to becoming doctors, whatever, all of their fees were paid by the government. Healthcare system was completely free for every Libyan. In fact, any Libyan that wanted to get married, the government would give them $50,000 US dollars to get married, to settle. And Gaddafi wanted to make, and of course he invested heavily in the rest of Africa as well, and he wanted to make the African continent become independent of Western dependence. So for instance, he had helped Africa, he launched a satellite for them through the Russian help, so that African countries could communicate directly with each other rather than going through their former colonial master, whether it was France or Britain or Germany or whatever other colonial power it was. Whenever they wanted to, for instance, two countries that are next door to each other, but one was a French colony, the other was a British colony, they couldn't dial directly. One had to go through France and the other had to go to Britain and connect there, and the French and the British were making tons of money out of them. So Gaddafi was helping these countries, and he was also, in fact, suggesting that there should be an African monetary fund. So these are some of the plans that he had, and that's why the Americans and the British and Canadians, incidentally, the war on Libya was waged, which was the commander of those forces was a Canadian general. That you know, they basically led that campaign to destroy Libya, to lynch Gaddafi publicly, and of course that infamous quote from Hillary Clinton that, you know, we came, we saw, and he died. And you know, this kind of imperialist, colonialist mindset, yes, that, you know, he was publicly lynched, and of course today we have Libya as a failed state. And of course a number of countries are now interfering in Libya. Now let's come to the external players that are present in Libya. You mentioned Turkey's forces and Erdogan, who has sent his forces over there, although he says that he has sent his forces to back the legitimate government that is recognized by the United Nations. And then there is that renegade general, General Khalifa Haftar, who incidentally is an American citizen as well. The Americans are backing him, and he claims to be, and he has, you know, occupied certain parts of Libya. And he says that he wants to be in power, and he has declared himself the field marshal. And we don't really know. I mean, a field marshal has to have a number of armies under his command, and he has these ragtag bands of militias, and he calls himself a field marshal. So it's a royal mess over there. And this is the direct result of Western policies of regime change and of disrupting these countries in different parts of the world. And you mentioned, of course, General Sisi, who now wants to get involved in Libya as well. Basically, what it is that Sisi, Egypt's economy under Sisi has nosedived, and Egypt is in really bad shape. Now, Sisi or Egypt under Sisi is also involved in a dispute with Ethiopia regarding the Renaissance Dam that Ethiopia is building on the Nile River. Now, we need to remember that the Nile River, actually part of it originates in Ethiopia and the other part originates in Sudan. And so, of course, one of the strange things about the Nile River is that it's the only river in the world that flows from south to north. Of course, it ends up in the Mediterranean Sea. And the Ethiopians naturally have a legitimate need. They need electricity, they need power. They've been negotiating with the Egyptians for many years, but unfortunately, no agreement has been arrived at. And so the Ethiopians have gone ahead with building that dam. Naturally, you know, the Ethiopians are obliged under international law to not block all of the water from downstream countries, because this is part of international law that no country can block the flow of rivers. Yet, for Sisi to divert attention from his failures in Ethiopia and in Egypt itself, he is now threatening to send his forces to Libya, and that would bring him into direct conflict with the Turkish forces over there. And if that were to happen, I think we would have a real mess, and it would be a terrible, terrible situation.
And by the way, Sisi is under the thumb of the British and Americans. Erdogan is a member of NATO. You can see that there are a lot of unpredictable, ugly things could happen here, because there are a lot of alliances that people never talk about that could suddenly emerge.
Yes, of course. I think we also need to keep in mind that Sisi is kept in power by the Americans, the British, and the Israelis. There's also deep links between Sisi's military as well as the Israeli military. And in fact, Sisi is part of this strangulation policy of Gaza, where 2 million people in Gaza are being starved to death. There is a total siege. So we see that in terms of his policies, he knows that he has no support internally. So he has to rely on external backers and get support from them, military support, or at least that they should not decide to get rid of him. And so he's playing along this game on their behalf. But you're right, this situation is really terrible. And if a war were to erupt between Egyptian and Turkish forces, I think we would have a very, very messy situation over there.
Yeah. Again, we're speaking to Zafar Bengash, and we're very glad that you're giving us this time, because we've accumulated a lot of burning issues. Canada and the United States are leading, I would say, Canada's following the United States, of the use of sanctions. And we have a situation in Syria and one in Islamic Republic that seem to me to be particularly ugly. These sanctions, particularly at the time of COVID-19, are particularly dangerous and destructive, and they're not legal. Am I right? And why isn't there more voice here? How is it that, frankly, we get away with committing a crime against the people of Syria and the people of Iran and other countries, actually?
Yes, of course. You know, particularly at a time when we have this pandemic, that the U.S. would impose additional sanctions on countries like Syria, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and a host of others because they do not submit to American demands. The American demands are completely unjustified. Like, you know, let's take the example of Syria. The U.S. Congress passed a bill which is called CSAR Act. Now, the act takes its name from Caesar is a fictitious name of supposedly of a Syrian military officer who has been supplying or providing information. In fact, The Intercept, which is a web magazine, Max Blumenthal is involved in it. They reported that this fictitious character, Caesar, the so-called Syrian military officer, actually does not exist. This is a myth that the Americans have invented. This is a CIA, you know, false information campaign, because they wanted to target the Syrian people. And, you know, U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo has made no secret of the fact that he has said that they want to punish the Syrian government, whereas in fact they are punishing the Syrian people by imposing these sanctions on Syria, because there is definitely, it has intensified food shortages in Syria. And the Americans are saying that they want the Syrian people to rise and overthrow the government in Syria. This, of course, won't happen. All that is happening is that it has intensified hunger in Syria. And Caesar Act is actually meant not so much to achieve any objectives inside Syria, but to target other countries such as Iran, or even some of the Gulf countries that are now on the verge of restoring diplomatic relations with Syria. The United Arab Emirates has already opened its embassy in Syria. The Saudis are also saying they want to open their embassy in Syria. And the Caesar Act is actually a warning to them not to do so, because the U.S. has still not given up on its regime change policy in Syria. And of course, we can see why the U.S. is so anxious to do that, because it wants to protect or it wants to raise Israel as the regional military power. And of course, you know, since this mercenary war that was launched against Syria, the Israeli Air Force has on a number of occasions bombed Syrian targets. It has killed people in Syria. And the U.S., of course, is part of that policy of imposing additional sanctions. Yeah. Also want to mention Venezuela, that has been suffering U.S. sanctions. And I'm glad that Iran came to its rescue. It has sent a number of fuel and food tankers to Venezuela. And they have defied American naval challenges in the Atlantic Ocean and around the Caribbean Sea. And Iran has been able to send so far, from what I can figure, at least 6 tankers to Venezuela. And the Venezuelan government, of course, is very grateful for that support, because they were virtually on the verge of collapse. Their oil industry, their refineries, etc., were on the verge of collapse. But because of Iran's help, they have been able to sustain their economy.
That was a very courageous and principled act. The international community should have applauded the rectitude, the lawfulness, the international solidarity of Iran to Venezuela. Zafar, I realize coming toward the end here that I didn't ask you about something which is a new development apropos of Syria. And that is that the United States is going after Lebanon. And Lebanon is now beginning to really suffer. Do they think they're going to accomplish? Because it seems to be part of this thing of trying to strangle, illegally strangle, Syria. But the forces there are not what they were 20 years ago.
That's correct. In fact, Lebanon has suffered terribly. The Lebanese pound, the also, of course, lira, has declined in value tremendously. In fact, there have been reports, and they're not just reports, but one can see it on the internet, on Facebook and other platforms, that Lebanese are so desperate for food that they have actually been putting out messages on Facebook that they are willing to sell their furniture if somebody could give them bread. So Lebanon is really being badly affected, because it's a small country.
And the U.S. is deliberately behind this, is it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, the U.S. ambassador in Lebanon has been going around issuing threats to the Syrian government and saying that the Libyan government that you must dissociate yourselves from Hezbollah, which has members of parliament, which are, you know, Hezbollah and its allies have the largest number of elected members in parliament. And yet the American ambassador goes around threatening the Lebanese government that it should dissociate itself from a legitimate political party.
A parliamentary democracy.
Exactly. And this is how America delivers democracy to other countries. So here you have a situation where, a legitimately established parliament elected by popular vote, and the American government, the American ambassador goes around making these ludicrous demands. And of course, as a consequence of American sanctions and American policies, that the Lebanese are suffering terribly. I also want to add a couple of other points, and that is that Hezbollah Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah announced last month, he said that China has offered to help us to invest in our country. In fact, Chinese have promised to invest something like $40 billion in Lebanon to build its infrastructure, to build its economy. And number two, Iran has offered to help Lebanon to strengthen its economy. And two Iranian oil tankers are anchored outside Lebanese waters, and the Lebanese government is unable to allow those tankers, oil tankers, to come in port because the Americans are threatening them. So although both China and Iran are willing to help Lebanon, the US is blackmailing Lebanon to not accept any of this help. And as a consequence of that, the Lebanese economy has been shattered. We must bear in mind that Lebanon hosts more than a million Syrian refugees that have been turned into refugees as a result of the war that was imposed on Syria. So we see that the overall game that the Americans are playing is to try to destroy Lebanon, to try to destroy Syria economically, and to bring them to their knees so that they will accept American demands and follow American policies.
And this is, we're seeing it, this is a kind of a doubling down on a bad bet by the Americans. They also are maintaining troops in Syria. It doesn't appear to me, though, that the U.S. plan is working. But it's like dealing with the devil. He has a new trick each day. Can you tell me, lastly, I guess, because we're using up all your time, and I'm very appreciative. Who are these forces that Erdogan's involved with, the Americans are involved with, so-called, I guess, they're Kurdish forces. I know that Noam Chomsky likes them. Syria, that where the Americans have their bases. How is that to be solved?
Well, you are right. There are Kurdish forces as well as there are these other ISIS forces in Idlib province. And what the Americans are doing is that the Americans are trying to continue to supply these ISIS terrorist forces with weapons, with logistical support. Although some of the people in that region have turned against the Americans, and in fact, there was weeks ago, there was an incident in which the people came out and they stopped an American convoy from proceeding, and it had to turn back. And so what the Americans are doing is to try to capture or control as many of Syria's oil fields as possible so that the Syrian government would be denied revenues from these oil fields. That's one aspect. The other is that Erdogan, of course, he uses this policy of trying to align with whatever forces that he can get in Syria. Regrettably, he still has not really reconciled to the fact that his policy has completely failed in Syria, and that it's time for him to cut his losses and to leave that place. Although, we know that there has been an agreement or a plan between Russia, Iran, and Turkey to de-escalate, and that the forces over there would be used in such a way that the forces of these three countries will try to keep the warring factions apart. Ultimately, of course, the Syrian government has pledged that they want to liberate all of their territory. They will not accept any foreign forces on their land. They will not accept any mercenaries on their territory, and that they do not want the Americans there because they never asked for the Americans to be there. But regrettably, the Americans are there because we need to understand that for much of America's history, it has been engaged in war. And we know that the American military, industrial, and now, of course, corporate banking sectors are all involved in it, and they know that wars are profitable business. So they want to have perpetual wars. And so long as there is you know, some interference from America in these countries, we need to remember that America has at least 900 military bases around the world. Mm. And they're not keeping peace anywhere. They're actually creating trouble for other people. And that applies to Syria, it applies to Iraq, it applies to Lebanon, it applies to Iran, it applies to all of these countries. And that is what is really taking place over there. Yeah.
The long, long struggle with imperialism. Zafar Bengai. Zafar is director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, crescent.ic-digital.org. It's been very enlightening, Zafar. There are so many things to talk about, and we are so grateful that you have shared your knowledge with us. Thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil, and take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.